All right. Hello and welcome, guys. I'm your host, history teacher, broadcaster, and writer, Matt Perry. So glad that you have decided to click on the join button when you saw it pop up on CastBox. Naomi, hello, and thank you for joining. So before we get started, let's get all the basics out of the way. I love interacting with the audience. So if you have any questions, please feel free to just type them in. Also, if you wish to call in, you could click the little call button and you could ask questions live over the air. And last but not least, please do, if you have the time and you like what you hear, I'm doing awesome, Naomi, how are you? If you have time and you like what you hear, go to CastBox and type in The Odd Past. That is my podcast. You can listen to previous episodes, and I take these live recordings and put them on that feed. So the name of the podcast is The Odd Past. All right, so as you can see from the name of tonight's episode, we're going to talk about the rise of Ulysses S. Grant. So 1861 is come and gone. The South is winning the war in battle, in regards to battle. Again, we talked about the economic side of everything. The Anaconda Plan is slowly wrapping itself around the southern ports, but it's not taking a huge toll as of yet. The rise of U.S. Grant is one of the best studies in the American dream, or what pluck and determination and steadfastness can get you in this country. U.S. Grant was born in the small town of Point Pleasant, Ohio, and he was born to Jesse Grant, his dad, and his mother raised him as just a simple country boy from the outskirts of the Ohio country. Ohio was a brand new state. It had only been around for about 30 years by the time that Grant was born. It was still the West. When you talk about the Western frontier, it was near the Western frontier. You know, this was before California was a state. This was before the gigantic westward expansions of the 1840s, 50s, 60s, and so on. So Grant was this Western kid, and he was a small kid. even as an adult, now you see pictures, his presidential portraits and everything. Yeah, he got a little plump in old age, but Grant was never very tall, about 5'6" and 5'7" between that. And he, not a sickly child, but just a scrawny kid. His dad was a tanner, and he moved his family around along the Ohio River a lot during Grant's adolescence. They moved between the Ohio River towns of like Newport, Kentucky, back up into Ohio, and all along the Ohio River route. When you lived along the Ohio River, there was always work to be had as a tanner or as a businessman of any kind. So he followed the money. Grant grew, and he realized very early that he wasn't the rough and tumble kid like other backwoods kids of his era. While other kids would go out and, you know, wrestle around, fight, things like that, and he wasn't interested in that. Grant was, from the very beginning, now he wasn't a scholar. I don't want you to think that Grant was some genius kid with his nose in a textbook all day. He enjoyed to read, and that was his favorite pastime, but he enjoyed to read novels. It would actually get him in trouble later in life. But his favorite pastime was to collect novels and read novels and stay inside or just hang out on his back porch or around his house. The one outdoor pursuit that U.S. Grant excelled in was horsemanship. From a very early age, Grant had a knack with horses. He was so good with horses that his services were sought after in the towns that he lived in. If people had a very fiery young colt and had problems breaking him in, they would call, they would go and send for to Jesse Grant's house and ask his son Ulysses to come and help them out. If you are interested in more about U.S. Grant than the half-hour program that I'm going to do tonight, I cannot recommend a book highly enough as the book called American Ulysses. And I'm going to put a link of American Ulysses in the chat. American Ulysses is one of the best biographies that I have ever read, let alone of Grant. Author Ronald C. White has a knack for writing that keeps you engaged throughout the entire book. It is not a short book, but Grant's life was not easily described. It is a page-turner, and very rarely do I call a biography a page-turner. But it gives great insight into the decisions, the character, and the man that Grant would become. So if you're interested in more about Grant, follow that link and give support to one of the great historians of our time, Ronald C. White. He has won multiple awards. He was a finalist for the Gilder Lehrman Military Book Prize for American Ulysses, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list. So check it out. Now, enough of the unpaid sponsorship. I just think it's a great book, and I know all the history nerds in here listening would probably agree if you give it a try. Grant grows, and very early, he has this love-hate relationship with his father. He and his father were never best pals. He and his father never saw eye to eye on hardly anything. His father wanted Ulysses to be something great. Now, Ulysses was his middle name, but as a stroke of fortune that comes later on, his names will be reversed, but his middle name was Ulysses, and that was his birth name. So for his young child, he gave his child this middle name Ulysses because he wanted him to be a great figure. That's why he gave him the name Ulysses. And it was something that Grant got teased about a lot, but something that he grew to, grew to deal with. So Jesse Grant is working behind the scenes without young Ulysses knowing at all what his father was up to. His father was trying to secure him a place at the United States Military Academy. Grant had no desire to be in the military, to be a soldier, to go to New York, none of it. It was not even on his radar. But Jesse Grant wanted his son to be special. Now, to get appointed to West Point, you had to have congressional, you had to have somebody from the Congress to put your name forward as a candidate for the school. So Grant is going around and begging congressmen to give his son a chance. And finally, around the age of 15, Grant does receive congressional, appointment to West Point. He is flabbergasted. Again, this was not even on his radar. He didn't even think about it. He didn't know his dad was up to it, and he doesn't know how to react. Already, he has this strained relationship with his father, and now he is even more incensed with his dad because he's now being sent off to school all the way near the Canadian border at West Point, New York, and it wasn't what he wanted in life. To Grant's credit, even as a teenager, he understood, though, that this was an opportunity. His idea at the onset was to go to West Point, hopefully graduate. That was not an easy task. Hopefully graduate, spend a couple of years maybe teaching, and then go about his life. It is required that you serve in the military if you go to West Point after you graduate. And he thought, well, that's no big deal. He'll take care of it. No biggie. So Grant goes to West Point. It's the first time he's been away from home, and now he might as well be a world away before the railroads were sufficient. It was a tough going on multiple railways, canals, overland, just to get to New York. When he gets to West Point, he immediately has a gigantic change in his life. The congressman that appointed him to West Point wrote his name wrong. And so, as we know him as Ulysses S. Grant, his middle name was Ulysses, but they messed it up, and Academy rules absolutely forbade changing anything on the paperwork. So from then on, the U.S. Army and they said, oh, your name's changed. So from then on, his name was Ulysses Sam Grant. His buddies called him Sam up at West Point. His future wife would call him Yules, U-L-S, U-L-Y-S. It's hard to pronounce for me. I apologize. Ulysses, whatever you want to call it. So Grant goes to West Point, and he immediately gets his name changed out of nowhere, and he chafes immediately at the requirements at the school. When you went to West Point, you did not only have to go to class. Obviously, you had to learn to be a good soldier. The academics were strenuous, and the behavior was strenuous. At West Point, they had a system of ranking students based on their academic performance and their military decorum, and it would rank you based on how many demerits you received. You could receive demerits for almost anything. Grant himself received many demerits because he hated going to church. So on Sunday morning, when it was supposed to be a day off, you know, the guys don't have class, they want to relax, but they would be forced to march in their fancy uniforms and go to the chapel. He would skip chapel a lot, and it affected his ranking at West Point. But Grant was one of these guys that really didn't give a damn about his ranking. He wanted to finish, but being first in the class or being 32nd in the class really didn't mean a hill of beans to him. And that is a character trait of, you know, not trying to put on airs, not trying to put on a show, that will very much help him in the future. So Grant does okay in the basics. He excels in mathematics. He is very good at mathematics. But his greatest asset is his horsemanship once again. the people that were at West Point with him in the 1840s said he was the greatest horseman that they had ever seen. Even the men in charge of the stables at West Point would, just like the people back home, ask him to break in the cranky, hard-to-handle young horses. Grant would say that in his life, and he said this even when he was one of the most famous military commanders in the United States, he would say his one wish in life was to retire at home quietly and spend his days leading a colt around. That was his favorite thing in the world to do. That and reading novels, as I alluded to. See, at West Point, they actually frowned upon reading novels. They thought it was frivolous and a waste of time. If you weren't reading texts or if you weren't working on your schoolwork, it was a waste of time. Grant, again, would risk these demerits. He would sneak to the library and read novels just to pass the time. So it was through this contentious schooling that Grant, he did. He was very good at his studies. He didn't give a darn about his decorum, really. He finished middle of his class, and he graduated West Point. When he graduates West Point, he serves in the Mexican-American War, which kind of pops up out of nowhere. And I don't want to get too much into his service tonight because of time and those types of issues, and I like to focus just on the Civil War, but he excels in battle in the Mexican-American War. He shows great bravery. During one battle, he volunteered to go get ammunition for a group of men that were low, and he rode through this Mexican town as bullets were whizzing all around him. He pulled what they called a Native American trick because they'd only seen the Apaches do it. He rode sideways on his horse. He went sideways and used the horse as kind of a gnat of a shield to get through the town. He was just brilliant on horseback. So Grant finishes the Mexican-American War. He detested the Mexican-American War. He thought it was one of the most shameful events in American history, America picking on Mexico. And we could debate that till the cows come home, but Grant was adamant in saying that the Mexican-American War should never happen. He returns, and now he decides to move. He doesn't decide, the military decides for him, but he decides to stay in Missouri. And he falls in love with a slave owner's daughter, Julia Dent. Now, Julia Dent was actually, she was one of the plainer daughters of the Dent family. Everybody always thought it would be her sister that would have callers coming after her. But this young man, Grant, looked beyond the surface. Julia had this situation with her eyes where one of her eyes was cross-eyed at times, and she was embarrassed of that. And the family would tease her, saying, well, you're never going to find a suitor. You're going to be a spinster. But Grant saw beyond the surface, and he saw the intelligence and the warmth and the love that Julia gave him. And they slowly but surely fall in love. They would go on long horseback rides together. They would spend, and he, what made him so special was that he didn't talk down to this woman. So often back then it was, you know, women sit there, look pretty, knit something in the corner and just listen. But he wanted to know what she thought because the slavery issue is boiling. Her father owned slaves. Grant comes from a family. Jesse Grant, his father, was an ardent abolitionist, and he personally knew John Brown, who would make the raid on Harper's Ferry and would kill many people in the name of abolition. So you have this dichotomy of Grant trying to fit in with this family that owns slaves, and his entire upbringing goes against that. He never got close to Julia's father, but he earned the begrudging respect of Julia's father. And eventually he acquiesced and gave him permission to ask Julia to marry him. Their marriage took place in the 1850s, and life was very difficult from the get-go for the young Grant family. Grant was stationed different places in the military. And when he was finally sent to the Northeast in Oregon and Washington, he became so despondent that he quit. He resigned his commission under a cloud. Some people said he was forced to resign because he was drinking out in the Pacific Northwest. Some people said it was because he missed his family. We will never know because it never went to a court martial. He simply resigned his commission as an officer in the United States military. He returns home and he tries to become a farmer. He's terrible at it. He cannot get anything to grow on his patch of land. He calls his farm hard scrabble because that was what every day was like, was just a hard scrabble clawing existence to survive. But Julia stood behind him. He eventually has to go hat in hand back to his estranged father in Galena, Illinois. He and his father did not have a good relationship, especially as Ulysses was an adult. He goes back to his father in 1860 and begs for a job at his harness shop in Galena, Illinois. Grant would go from Mexican-American war hero, military officer, to now he was just a clerk working in his dad's harness-making shop. Quite the fall. And it took quite the mental toll on him. But with his perseverance that he showed, he pushes through, and Grant is making a decent living for his young family. That's when the Civil War breaks out. And Grant sees and feels that it's his duty to offer his services to the state of Illinois in any way that they would see fit. Again, he has all this military experience. But what we must remember about the Civil War, and it's something we're going to talk about a lot throughout this series, your merits didn't necessarily give you rank. This was a time of political appointments. You could be made a brigadier general with zero military experience. Grant did not have political pull. He didn't know the governor of Illinois. He wasn't buddies with a senator or a congressman. He was just a harness maker's clerk that used to be in the military. So when he offers his services, he's asked to help recruit volunteers. And he does that job dutifully and wonderfully. But he is aching for more. He wants more out of this. He sees all these political appointments being pushed ahead of him, and he understands that he can bring something special to the military. He's eventually given a commission, and he's given control of what would become known as the Army of the Tennessee, and the district, and he sets his base of operations in early 1862 up at Cairo, Illinois. It's a Mississippi River town. So Grant has the Army of Tennessee under his command. He is a nobody in the grand scheme of things. People don't know about him in the East. Lincoln doesn't know about him. All of the big drama that people pay attention to is taking place near Washington, D.C., in Virginia, like the Battle of Bull Run and things like that. But Grant loved that. Grant didn't want to be in the newspapers. Grant did not want to be, you know, on the fast track. He didn't want to rub elbows with the politicians. He simply wanted to do his job, and he wanted to defeat the Confederacy. So Grant starts coming up with a plan of how he is going to hurt the Confederates along the Mississippi River area. Again, yesterday we talked about the Mississippi River was the main avenue of transportation in this country, and whoever controlled the Mississippi River would have the upper hand, to say the least. Grant decides that he is going to take his army, and he's going to do something that other officers didn't even really think about, and that's what kind of boggles the mind now. He wanted to use the Navy. You know, so often there was the rancor between the Army and the Navy, not getting along, blah, blah, blah. He said, and he thought, I need to use the Navy to my advantage. I need to work hand in hand with the Navy. And so he works with Andrew Foote, who commanded the Navy, and he devises a plan in February of 1862. He wants to attack the earthen fort on along the Kentucky and Tennessee border known as Fort Donelson. Fort Donelson was a, it's not an impressive fort to look at it today, but it was a very, very important stronghold because it would stop all northern traffic along the Mississippi River. He decides that he is going to take Fort Donelson. And he uses the Navy to absolute perfection. And after the battle begins on February the 11th, they bombard Fort Donelson. And Grant is noticing that this isn't quite working. And so he orders his men to advance. Grant surrounds Fort Donelson and cuts off all the supplies coming into the fort. Simon Bolivar Buckner and Gideon Pillow are the commanders inside of Fort Donelson. Pillow actually takes off and he leaves Fort Donelson during this siege, and he gives command to Simon Bolivar Buckner. Buckner asks Grant, finally, he raises a white flag and he says, what is it going to take to, let's end this. What are your conditions for surrender? And this is where Grant earns his nickname. And Grant shows that this, he is not the common soldier. You know, everybody was during the 1860s, they were still under this assumption that you had to be this dashing, always, you know, wearing gloves and always showing the absolute highest decorum. Again, Grant didn't give a damn about that stuff. So when Buckner is asking what are the conditions of giving up Fort Donelson, Grant simply says there are no conditions. It's unconditional surrender. And from that day forward, the Northern press would say his initials stood for unconditional surrender, Grant. Buckner is insulted. And he is angry that Grant is requiring he and his men to give up everything. There is going to be no grand parade of retreating Confederates. Buckner becomes a prisoner of war. So Grant wins this major victory using the Navy and the Army in perfect harmony at Fort Donelson. He would soon set his eyes on Fort Henry further down the Mississippi River. But this victory at Fort Donelson propels Grant from a nobody in the Western theater of the war to now, hey, look, we won a major victory in the Western theater. We won a major victory in the Mississippi River. That's huge. And this is the first time that Grant is brought to Lincoln's attention. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed tonight's discussion on unconditional surrender, Grant, and the Battle of Fort Donelson. Tomorrow, we go back to the Eastern Theater of the War, and we talk about George B. McClellan, his Peninsula campaign, and his never-ending request for more men. Remember to check us out at the Odd Past Podcast. Andy, thank you for listening. The Odd Past Podcast, just type that into your search bar, and you will be able to listen to archived episodes and some of my other episodes on that feed. If you like what you hear, give me a follow. I'm going to try to do these every weeknight, but if not, I'll try to schedule other times as well. So until next time, this is Matt Perry, your host, saying good night, everybody.